An hour earlier, most of the men of Cabanatuan were squatting outside their barracks in their G-strings and burlap rags, sucking the runts of old cigarettes, enjoying the stillness of the gathering twilight. Evening chow was over, and the mess hall details were busy rinsing out the cauldrons, scraping the charred rice from the bottoms of pots. In the medical wards, several hundred men lay on the hard tatami mats, coughing sclerotic coughs, brushing away flies with languid sweeps of their hands. The Japanese could be heard across the way, frantically moving vehicles about, hoisting burlap sacks and stacking crates of supplies. In the late afternoon, three light tanks, along with two new platoons of Japanese soldiers, had been seen slipping into the camp. The smells of salty fish and simmering miso tendrilled through the barbed wire fence. To the northeast, a loose constellation of campfires speckled the scrubby margins of the Kabu River. A few minutes later, an airplane shot across the sky. It seemed to have appeared out of nowhere, as though a trap door had opened in the firmament. As the aircraft streaked low over the camp, Tommy Thomas caught a momentary glimpse of the twin-tailed contraption. It was black, futuristic, sleeker than any plane Thomas had seen before. He observed that the guards up in the tower were apoplectic, hurling themselves upon the floorboards. The plane flew exceedingly low, low enough so that A.B. Abraham thought he could easily hit it with a rock. All about the camp, the prisoners stared up in awe, wondering what the strange ship had in mind for them. The plane looked so different from anything else they'd seen that at first they thought it was German, or possibly Russian. Other prisoners described it as a black barn swallow, a War of the Worlds rocket, and an angel of death. To the men of Cabanatuan, the plane, whatever it was, seemed a powerful, almost eerie emblem of how far American technology had evolved in the 3 years of their captivity. Mechanically, logistically, conceptually, this was a different army. On Bataan, they'd starved in their shallow metal helmets, fighting old-fashioned pitched battles with dud shells and rusty artillery. 30-odd months later, they had only to gaze upon this sci-fi lozenge streaking through the clouds at 300 miles per hour to understand that everything, the whole social and industrial universe back home, had changed. It was as though they were looking at a new country, a new era. As night fell upon Nueva Ecija, the airplane vanished and the camp seemed preternaturally quiet and dark. Except for a few flickering coconut oil lamps lighting up the interiors of the medical wards, the grounds were thoroughly blacked out, in accordance with the standing Japanese policy to prevent air raids. At approximately 7:45, Dr. Hibbs was sitting on the steps of the American headquarters, enjoying a postprandial seminar on the stars with three close friends. Tommy Thomas was smoking a cigarette and conversing with the camp tailor outside the last building on the south end of the compound, only 30 feet from the Japanese fence. Medic Ralph Rodriguez was working at his typewriter in the medical office and playing records on a rickety phonograph that had arrived 2 years earlier in a Red Cross package. "We only had a couple of records, so we just played them over and over again," Rodriguez said. He put on an extremely groove-worn version of the old Tin Pan Alley song, "Wait Till the Sun Shines, Nelly," and stared out the window. The vapid tune seeped through the camp. Then she heard him softly say, "Wait till the sun shines, Nelly, and the clouds go drifting by. We will be happy, Nelly, don't you cry." A few seconds later, the scratchy melody was overwhelmed by a fusillade of gunfire erupting from the rear of the camp. Rodriguez could hear the screams of men, could see the traceries against the night sky. Bullets chewed through the NEPA thatching and drilled into the far wall. The song wouldn't shut up. Through the window pane, she looked at the rain. A squall of mortars, machine gun staccato. On instinct, prisoners everywhere hurled themselves into latrines, crawled under their barracks, burrowed into anything that felt like a hole. Dr. Hibbs dove into an irrigation ditch and listened to the sound, as Hibbs put it, of whistling slugs, Roman candles, and flaming meteors sailing over our heads. A.B. Abraham heard his buddies desperately conferring in their barracks. "Mother, oh mother, what a way to die." Abraham's first instinct was to defend himself. "They won't get me," he thought, "not without a fight." Abraham crept under his barracks and retrieved a long, knotted club that he'd buried beneath the floorboards weeks earlier. He returned to his bunk wielding the club, vowing to bludgeon the first Japanese executioner who ventured through the door. In the kitchen, where a POW named John Cook had just finished up the dishes, the hanging stockpots rattled and clinked in the relentless spatter of lead. A few seconds later, he heard the rupture of a grenade, then another. Rodriguez hurled himself on the floor of his office. "Ralph, shut that fucking thing off!" "Must we stay home, Joe?" she cried. "I said shut it off, goddammit!" "The bullets were thick as swarms of bees," one POW said, "and flying so close I could feel their heat on my bare skin." On the south end of camp, Tommy Thomas rolled into a drainage ditch, his heart thudding in his chest. "I heard screaming and moaning all around us," he said, "and I thought the Japs were finally massacring us." Crouched on the floor, Rodriguez reached over and shook the leg of the table, but the phonograph wouldn't stop. "Maybe we better not wander. Maybe we better not roam."